The shofar, my friends, offers us an ancient sound. These calls were blown in biblical Israel as the summons to arm or to assembly. The shofar reaches out to us across the centuries as a symbol of an ever-relevant past. It says to us, restless mortal, you value too highly your own handiwork. You have dismissed too abruptly the ancient wisdom. When you hear my call, listen again to the ancient voices. And it is true that we have been brash about our achievements. We throng to the triumphal procession of science, and we have eyes and ears only for our Caesar. We have buried the classic wisdom in the silence of our libraries, where it can afford an innocent amusement to the historically minded scholar. For we say to ourselves, what can these men, ignorant of the chemistry of the atom and of the mystery of the subconscious, what can these men have to tell me, have to tell us of real value for today? Indeed, such is the thrust of our pride that we have come to make a virtue out of novelty. Each year, like lemmings, we mass in our newly styled clothes and parade in our newly trimmed automobiles. Every generation or so, we turn our homes inside out and our schools, following some new fad in child-rearing or educational philosophy, whose main virtue is its novelty. We admit the label of modern art only to those works which violate every traditional technique. And we give ourselves away in the greeting with which we extend to one another. Well, what's new? Now, we have reason for pride. Our research in an avalanche of engineering has radically changed the basic structure of life and changed it for the better. We can now produce more than we can purchase. And an age which has this capacity for overproduction need no longer tolerate the cruelties of caste and of class by which earlier times rationalized the unequal distribution of inadequate wealth. We no longer need to turn man into a machine, for we have replaced the muscle and the sinew with automation and cybernetics. And we can look forward to a life in which every man, rich or poor, high-born or no, in which every man can look forward to a blend of labor and of leisure. The day of the agricultural serf and of the shantytown are numbered. An age of sophisticated medicine such as ours can promise the young their maturity, can permit the mature to look forward to longevity. There is a radically new dimension of opportunity to life in the 20th century, and it is we who built it in. All that is new is not necessarily noteworthy. Poison gas and the cobalt bomb are not noteworthy accomplishments. Nor is all that is experimental necessarily excellent. We We have had radically to revise our educational systems back towards traditional methods. I sometimes wonder whether men, centuries hence, will still be reading our free-forming poetry, or going to the theater to see staged our plays of the absurd, or whether they will be displaying in their museums our freestanding heaps of scrap iron. But more to the point, for all of our gadgets, for all of our production miracles, we have not been able to produce a more joyous and confident age. The jolting paradox of life at this juncture in time is that our scientific breakthrough has been accompanied by a spiritual breakdown. At least the ancients knew what to expect of life. They were prepared to accept its burdens and its distressing challenges. But we stand bemused, mute and confused. And what has our philosophy to tell us? Well, the burden of much that passes for philosophy at this moment seems to be this. You are born, make the most of it. You will die, accept your mortality. Que sera, sera. That which will be, will be. Existentialism and its daughters, for all its heavily larded psychiatric language, is nothing more than a refurbished banal fatalism. And it gives us no guidance, for it leaves off where wisdom ought to begin, for it can give us no information beyond the getting and the spending, the reproducing and the dying. Morality, I am afraid, has become sociology. We graph and we chart our idiosyncrasies and our inconsistencies, but these give us no guidance as to our obligation. We know more than we need to know about what we do do, but are not at all clear as to what we ought to do. And religion has lost much of its power to communicate the vision splendid. It has been sealed off from the workaday routine. It is a weekend childishness or a ceremonial trimming on stated occasions. For all of our academic accomplishment, we are far less confident, and I'm afraid far more neurotic than our ancestors. Well, what's for it? There is no virtue in damning change, as some of our frightened political rabbits seem intent on doing. The radical right is radically wrong. Man writes today on paper, not on birch bark. Time is inexorable. Change is irreversible. And honesty commands us to admit that it is not that yesterday was better, but rather that we have failed to take full advantage of the promise which is ours. Nor is there any virtue in stumbling along without goal, without aim, without purpose. Many of us struggle desperately to get ahead without even knowing why the battle has been joined. There is no more self-destructive ambition than status-seeking, and none that is more condemned and consigned to failure. And even if we lack such social pretensions, What joyousness can be ours in a life of wage earning and homemaking where we never lift our eyes beyond the backyard's fence? Now we can, if we wish, play the ostrich, flip quickly from the news and the headlines to the sports and the amusements and the comics. But we cannot prevent the drama of our day from impinging upon the privacies of our lives. Recently, there was produced on Broadway a play with the revealing title, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. Well, we can't get off. There is no exit short of the grave. What's for it then? The remedy of the shofar. The symbol of the shofar calling us to look back, to renew our acquaintance with the knowledge which our ancestors forged centuries and centuries ago. To listen again to the knowledge which brought confidence to far less hopeful ages. To listen again to the insight into the human situation, into a human situation which was far more desperate than our own. To listen again to the words of the prophet Jeremiah. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me. That I am the Lord who exercises justice, mercy, and righteousness. And that in these things do I delight. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Is this not the burden of my prologue, that knowledge itself is not enough? Indeed, that knowledge, if it is not blended to a sound and hale spiritual constitution, can be a crippling advantage. The governor of Alabama, the blood guilty governor of Alabama, is a college graduate certified in the difficult profession of the law. No nation granted greater distinction to its academics than did pre-World War II Germany. Yet it was these of the intelligentsia who programmed Hitler's missiles, who forged his racial biologies, and who performed those garish and ghoulish human experiments on tens of thousands of concentration camp guinea pigs. Nor have our best scientists, and the best scientists of all the advanced nations of the world, solved the modern absurdity, which is their devotion of highly honed intellect to no more promising or lasting an enterprise than a refinement of the weapons of war. Ignorance is an abomination. But knowledge alone is not the way to human salvation. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Have we not had a surfeit in our world of nationalist dictators and successful revolutionaries who have willfully and deliberately set about to reconstruct their economy and their politic without giving a thought to the lives of the tens of thousands of citizens which they were crippling and hobbling and cursing? We possess the greatest military might that the world has ever forged. Has it permitted us to enlarge the ambit of our allies or of our ideals? Power restrains madness. It has its own built-in insanity. Our $50 billion military budget has served only to compound the danger of war by political miscalculation with the danger of war by mechanical malfunction. The hotline which has been joined between the Kremlin and the White House is not designed to restrict human impetuosity, but to limit a holocaust which might be upon us because of accidental mechanical mischance. In the struggle for peace, power is a puny weapon. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. Will a well-filled bank vault be an adequate shelter in the case of atomic attack? Has all of our largesse, the gift of our prosperity, bought us friendship? We are members of the most affluent society the world has ever known. Can we claim it to be the most serene and joyous? I am afraid that the statistics of aggressive delinquency, the marital breakdown, and of mental illness are as staggering in our suburbs as in our city slums. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth God. The supreme human achievement is a meaningful worship. Not weapons, not wealth, not even wisdom, but a meaningful worship. Serenity can be ours in life only if we have become one with the supreme energy which has created life. But speak of faith, and many who are drenched with the spirit of our age become restless, and they begin to squirm. Faith demands that we go beyond logic and beyond reason. And we have been conditioned to accept only that which we can see and measure and feel. Or have we? Strangely, it is only in the discussion of faith that the modern seeks to choke off his mind at the limits of the demonstrable. We love. Could logic build love for us? We prize democracy and freedom. Can we argue these objectively and defend them factually? We cannot. If faith transcends reason, it does not deny reason. It is merely unsatisfied with a life which is lived only within the four L's of material things. The modern is unhappy with a prescription which speaks of faith, of belief, of commitment as the ultimate solution to our confusion. Faith has an awkward, shop-worn ring. But I would ask you for the moment to put aside your preconceptions and your prejudgments. I would ask you to remember that so much which passes for religion popularly and publicly is at best a shoddy travesty, and at its worst, an abomination. Faith is not a mumbled invocation before we get down to the serious business of eating. Faith is not a daily dozen of biblical texts which we recite in the hope that it will improve our success quotient. Faith is not the mechanical stamping onto our coins of a pious motto. Faith is not the monotone of the teacher reading a biblical text at the beginning of a classroom lesson. Faith is not a shortcut to healing. Faith does not give credential to the credulities and the superstitions of the ignorant. Faith is a commitment to life. Faith is a vision of life as something more than eating, sleeping, and wenching, and dying. Where shall we find faith? You will not find faith in those glorified folk legends which are presented to us by the mass media as its credentials. Nor will you find faith in those little vignettes which appear from time to time in the public press, telling us how this desperate, shipwrecked fellow poured out his fears and was accidentally saved. Faith begins when we can see the supernatural in the ordinary, when we can see God in our daily routine, when we have begun to thrill to the miracle of our daily reawakening, when we are given pause by the beauty of our physical surroundings and of our physical endowment. Faith begins in love and in loss, in the smile and in sacrifice, in thought and in search, and in the recognition that we did not implant these sensitivities within ourselves. Faith begins when man is humbled before creation, before its entire majesty, and when that humility brings him to his knees and to the acknowledgement that he must respond to this blessing by blessing his life with a certain discipline and quality, morality, worship, are man's response to faith. Where shall we find faith? Faith begins in anxiety. Faith begins when we can admit to ourselves that we will die. Faith begins when we can admit to ourselves that we are not the masters, the sculptors of our own destiny, that we are chained to a wheel of fortune and can only stay its turning to a certain degree. Our strength will soon wane. Our mind will become forgetful. Our powers will lose their keenness. To live is to be bruised. To live is to lose. When we can admit that we are not the rock of Gibraltar and that God is the rock on whom we all depend, then faith begins to burgeon, to seed, and to grow. But our anxiety must be one coupled with sound understanding. For we must already have recognized that in the ordinary human ambitions, there is no stillness, no confidence, no serenity, no joyousness for the inner life of man. What have we gained for all the indulgence of luxury? What will we have gained for all the pleasures of dispensing power? What will we have gained by chocking our mind with factual knowledge. Beyond all these ordinary ambitions lies a graceful, God-given way of life. And it is the way of faith. Let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord who exerciseth justice and mercy and righteousness, that in these things I delight. Faith is a search. The way of faith is long and tedious and filled with obstacles. There is no man of such certain faith that he does not question and look anew. But some of us are so impatient, time-harried, that after one unsatisfying experience in the sanctuary, or after we have hurled one why to the heavens and it has gone unanswered, we turn aside, we give up, we've had enough. Would we tire of a great symphony with only one listening? Does not each audience enthrall us the more? We begin to see its subtleties and construction, its depths of feeling. There are no shortcuts to faith. It requires worship, the discipline of worship. It requires study, the discipline of study. It requires a way of life which is led in dignity and devotion. For though we are all searching for God, we are all clear as to the will of God. Against our ordinary human ambitions, he has set up a moral triumvirate: justice, mercy, righteousness. These are the legitimate goals of life. These are the legitimate standards of life. They require no arcane initiation. They are clear and self-evident, fundamental. And wherever we be on the ladder of faith, amateur, beginner, or long familiar, this way of righteous living, this obligation imposed upon us by the will of God, is possible to us. And strangely, as we bestir ourselves to do the good, to bring happiness into our homes, to fulfill our kindly instincts, to sacrifice our pleasures for service, as we begin to do the good, reach out towards our fellow men, we find God reaching back to us. For all of our confusions, the shofar be symbol of the remedy. The remedy of the ancient wisdom of faith. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord who exerciseth justice, righteousness, and mercy, and that in these things do I delight. Amen.